Books. Books. Books.
Books. Hello, and welcome to Didn't Read It, the podcast that is certain its affluence and good taste will save it from the horrors. I am your host, Grace Todd, and with me today is frequent friend of the pod, Lee.
Hello.
Hey, baby.
Hello.
How you doing?
Great.
Glad to have you here.
I'm so glad to be here.
Couldn't be more excited.
Yes.
Beside ourselves with joy.
I'm positively bubbling over.
How you doing? How's things? I was going to ask you, like, what fiction you'd been reading lately, but I ambushed you with that one last time. And
I'm still reading the same book. Yeah.
I
read slow. I don't actually haven't picked it up in a few days. I do not read as fast as you do. I've just been chilling, working, being a human being.
Being a people.
Being a people as best I can.
All right.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
Some days, no.
But what choice have we but to endure?
Is this foreshadowing?
The horrors persist, but so do I. Well, Lee, as you probably remember, unless you've become an amnesiac in the intervening period.
Become. I already was.
Hey, I have no idea where I am or what I'm doing.
Usually.
We got together not too long ago to discuss Arthur Machen's The Bowmen.
I do remember that.
Wow. Look at you go. And that was a sort of like rah-rah magical thinking borderline propaganda piece.
Borderline.
That spawned, well, yeah. Depending on who you ask, I guess. And it spawned like its own sort of war myth that, you know,
yeah,
the white patriarchal English god himself descended from the heavens to bless the Allies in World War One.
Yeah. It's like, I definitely want England to win.
Exactly.
More than this other European country for some reason.
Yep. 100%.
Yeah.
Joan of Arc was there. It was a whole thing.
Yeah.
main character of the war, Phyllis Campbell.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And her TikTok account.
And her viral videos.
A TikTok account in spirit, if not in actuality.
Just 100 years too soon.
Yeah.
Yeah. But for that glitch.
So
close. She would have been a great TikToker.
What's funny is how clearly I can see it in my mind's eye so crisply. Anyway. So that was kind of kicking off a little bit of an on again, off again World War One arc.
Will they or won't they? They will. Twice.
Destroy the world as we know it and send society into a tailspin from which it will only recover via a second world war. They will. Aw, meet cute.
Two thumbs up.
So today we're going to kind of continue that journey, and we're going to stay for a little while longer on the home front before we pivot to the literature of the trenches themselves.
Okie dokie.
Because part of what I'm so interested in about this is the stories that people tell themselves when they are at home away from the fighting,
mm-hmm,
but are nonetheless being affected by it as you would, you know, unavoidably.
Like you are.
In part because I think that speaks very clearly to a position that a lot of us are in right now.
Every day.
Right? You know this thing is happening.
Yeah.
You have very little control over it.
Yeah.
It is inevitably affecting the life that you are living,
mm-hmm,
but you're also at arm's length from it in a way that is really, I think, confusing for a lot of people and makes it both hard to process and hard to take seriously.
Yeah. This is real so fast. This is getting so real so fast. I wasn't ready.
Sorry. Sorry.
Thought you were going to read me a story.
I am. I'm sorry.
I said I wasn't going to get sad this time.
My bad. No, this is going to be great.
It's a Friday.
It's a Friday and I just want to enjoy myself.
Nope, it's fine. Let's talk about it.
So today, building on the conversation we started with the Bowmen, we're going to talk about a story that is still on the home front, but it is a little bit more, or a lot of bit more, realistic.
Okay.
And is also from the feminine perspective.
Ooh.
No, not Phyllis Campbell's perspective.
Oh.
Other women. Different women.
There are no other women.
Phyllis Campbell, the only woman of World War I.
The woman.
She 100% would have been making viral videos about people trying to kidnap her in Target parking lots if she were alive today.
Yeah.
Maybe she's the podcast's nemesis. It's only a shame that she's been dead for like 100 years, probably.
You know what? We could do some summoning.
Ooh, nemesis seance.
Can you summon a ghost just to fight with it?
I don't see why
not. Do people do that?
I mean, isn't that what an exorcism is?
True. All right, our evening is booked now. Got some stuff to do later tonight.
Black Iris won't mind us having a seance, right?
No.
Okay.
Won't be the first.
That is probably true.
Yeah.
What we are going to discuss before our seance to fight with Phyllis Campbell's ghost, we are going to talk about, and I'm going to tell you the story of, Rebecca West's The Return of the Soldier.
Okay.
Have you heard of this book, or are you familiar with Rebecca West at all?
I think I am getting both her name and the title confused with other things, so I'm going to say no. I don't think I have heard of them. I think I've heard of people and things that sound like them.
That's fair. Rebecca West, this was one of her first novels.
Okay.
She went on to have a pretty incredible career.
Ooh.
She became a journalist. She won a bunch of awards.
Cool.
Lived into her 90s.
Ooh.
Died in the 80s. Like, I mean, she...
Wow.
Yeah, she has done a bunch of stuff. So it's thoroughly possible that her name is actually ringing a bell, even if you can't quite put a pin in why.
Okay, because I keep thinking of Rebecca Black.
Wait, like the Friday?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, she's done a lot of stuff since then.
I mean, you did yell, for the record. You did yell, it's a Friday, not that long ago, so I can see why.
It's a Friday, Friday, Friday.
And we're going to talk about World War One.
I don't know any of the other words.
So this is one of her first novels. She wrote it when she was like 26, 25, 26.
Wow.
Wrote it during the war. It was published not too long after, like pretty immediately after. And it's a pretty incredible piece of work, especially for a 26-year-old.
Yeah.
It's a very elegant, kind of sparse little novel.
Mm-hmm. I love those.
Me too,
yeah,
actually. And I think it approaches both World War One specifically and war narratives from the home front in general in a way that is deceptively complicated and deceptively effective.
Hmm.
You can let me know if you agree with me after we've made it through the text.
Okay.
But
I like that phrase, deceptively complicated. That's a real thinker.
It's a little sneak attack of a book.
Interested to see what you mean by that. Also, can I say that that edition that you're holding is a beautiful lime green.
It is. It's very bright, which is a choice.
I like it.
I like it, too.
Doesn't sound like you like it.
Well, it's just that it's a shade of lime green.
I was trying to compliment the book.
No, it's a lovely edition.
Mm-hmm.
It's just funny to me because it is a shade of lime green that, based on the endless, endless meditations we get on aesthetics in the book itself, every woman in this book would have hated it.
Oh, interesting.
Just by, you know,
adversarial cover design.
I just feel like lime green was not really their bag.
Okay.
But maybe I'm wrong. They did love their bright colors.
Me too.
Who doesn't? Except maybe
you.
Except maybe Kitty. All right. Let's get into it. "Don't begin to fuss," wailed Kitty. If a woman began to worry in these days because her husband hadn't written to her for a fortnight, besides, if he'd been anywhere interesting, anywhere where the fighting was really hot, he'd have found some way of telling me instead of just leaving it as somewhere in France. He'll be all right. We were sitting in the nursery. I had not meant to enter it again, now that the child was dead. But I had come suddenly on Kitty as she slipped the key into the lock, and I had lingered to look in at the high room, so full of whiteness and clear colors, so unendurably gay and familiar, which is kept in all respects as though there were still a child in the house.
Goo.
Start off strong.
Wow.
We open in an English country estate, which is inhabited by Kitty and Jenny. Kitty's husband, Chris, is off serving in the war. Mm-hmm. Jenny is Chris's cousin.
Okay.
They are the only occupants of the house.
Okay.
There was a child. Obviously, there is not a child anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And in this opening scene, Jenny comes upon Kitty, who is going into the nursery because it has the window in which the sunlight enters through the best angle for her to dry her hair.
All right. Okay. Nope. Go on.
And for a moment, Jenny thinks that she's caught Kitty going in to experience a private grief. And that's when Kitty is like, no, this is just where I like to let my hair dry in the sun. And goes on to complain that she wishes Chris hadn't kept the room a nursery since Oliver, the infant, is now gone. And there's no chance of there being any more children.
Okay.
So
that's setting up a lot very quickly.
Yeah, we are on like the third paragraph of the book.
Yeah, that is concise.
Rebecca West's ability to convey huge amounts of information in very short periods of time is awe-inducing. And it means that getting through this is going to be, it's going to be a lot of pausing.
Yeah.
Okay, in one sentence she has conveyed.
Yeah.
Three paragraphs worth of backstory.
Yeah, let's process.
But it also tells you that Kitty and Chris are, at least by Kitty's estimate, too old to try again.
Too old. Okay. Got it.
And that's, they managed to have one son. He died. And it's now this household of just these two women waiting for Chris to return from the front.
Yeah.
And Jenny goes on to kind of meditate on how empty all of it is without Chris at the center of it. And by implication, without the child at the center of it. Because, you know, I mean, unfortunately, it's 1916 or 17
mm-hmm.
in the book. And babies had a tough go of it.
Infant mortality rates were higher.
In the early 1900s.
Yeah.
So the novel's narrated in first person. Jenny is explaining all of this to us okay. herself.
Jenny the cousin.
Jenny the cousin.
Yeah.
Jenny the spinster cousin.
Oh, I don't know.
Which is not at all an awkward position. I mean, imagine being the third wheel spinster cousin with a married couple and no one else in the house.
Oh, yeah. No, thanks.
It's great.
Yeah.
West gives us a lovely description of this rural estate. The nursery window has a beautiful view of the gardens and the fields beyond, and it's just sort of an idyllic view of the English countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And Jenny says, that day, its beauty was an affront to me, because, like most Englishwomen of my time, I was wishing for the return of a soldier. Disregarding the national interest and everything else except the keen prehensile gesture of our hearts toward him, I wanted to snatch my cousin Christopher from the wars and seal him in this green pleasantness his wife and I now looked upon. And she goes on to say, of late I had had bad dreams about him. By nights I saw Chris running across the brown rottenness of no man's land, starting back here and there because he trod upon a hand, not even looking there because of the awfulness of an unburied head. And not until my dream was packed full of horror did I see him pitch forward on his knees as he reached safety. If it was that. For on the war films, I have seen men slip down as softly from the trench parapet, and none but the grimmer philosophers could say that they had reached safety by their fall. And when I escaped into wakefulness, it was only to lie stiff and think of stories I had heard in the boyish voice of the modern subaltern, which rings indomitable, yet has most of its gay notes flattened. We were all of us in a barn one night, and a shell came along. My pal sang out, help me, old man, I've got no legs. And I had to answer, I can't, old man, I've got no hands. Such are the dreams of English women today. I could not complain, but I wished for the return of our soldier.
Hmm.
And that very grim half joke about the got no legs, help me, I can't, I've got no hands,
mm-hmm.
becomes a recurring motif. It's something that she mentally revisits several times over the course of the book.
I like the sentence that she says, I can't complain, so I'm just going to say I wish he were back.
Right.
you know.
And it's implied that she then says that out loud, which actually loops all the way back around to the first sentence of the book. And that is when Kitty basically bitches her out.
Yeah. He's like, he's not even anywhere exciting.
Stop fussing.
Yeah.
So we can tell that Kitty is a paragon of thoughtfulness.
Yeah. Who's probably doing fine mentally.
Seems like it.
Yeah.
Jenny goes on to just, there are a couple things you cannot over underline in this book because it comes up in almost every paragraph. And this idea that the life that they are living in this beautiful house surrounded by these beautiful things is all for Chris, and that without him at the heart of it, they are just kind of going through the motions. There's no depth to what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
because he's not there. And this whole life that they are maintaining, this estate, these gardens, all of these things that they're doing are for him. What she says is, I tried to build about me such a little globe of ease as always ensphered her, Kitty, and thought of all that remained good in our lives, though Chris was gone. I was sure that we were preserved from the reproach of luxury, because we had made a fine place for Chris. One little part of the world that was, so far as surfaces could make it so, good enough for his amazing goodness. Here we had nourished that surpassing amiability, which was so habitual, that one took it as one of his physical characteristics, and regarded any lapse into bad temper as a calamity as startling as the breaking of a leg. Here we had made happiness inevitable for him. I could shut my eyes and think of innumerable proofs of how well we had succeeded, for there never was so visibly contented a man.
Is this like we're doing our duty on the home front by making a good home for him to return to, or is it like, I don't exist without this authority figure in my life, or?
Yes. I mean, so.
Is it just like I miss my cousin, or is this like I don't know who I am outside of the structure of this relationship?
Both.
Okay.
West's narration underlines this over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they have done. I mean, really think about the subtext of, here we had made happiness inevitable for him. That's a wild turn of phrase.
I can't really think about it because I don't really understand how that's possible. So I can't.
Well, it's ominous, right? Like,
yeah.
It reminds me of those ominous affirmations that you see, you know, like better days are coming, you cannot prevent them, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's a little eerie to think about. We had made a happiness inevitable.
Yeah, like he's gonna be happy.
Right.
He's
and
gonna like it.
It's, yeah, like he can't help himself. We have look at all we've done. And so it immediately sets up this dynamic where Chris is both the only thing that they can define themselves through, but also as a direct byproduct of that is kind of he's both Godhead and child in a weird way.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm uncomfortable. Well, and it's also interesting, West's choice of Jenny as the narrator is also interesting because I guess that's something you wouldn't be as surprised to hear a wife say, to hear a spouse say, but to have like a cousin say it. I mean, I know cousins were a little different back then in England, but
Jenny the spinster cousin.
I'm uncomfortable is what I'll say.
Well, it's only going to get...
No! Don't tell me that.
It's only going to get comfier and more normal from here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good.
And then all of this takes a hard left turn into an episode of The Care Bears.
Oh.
Whew. The Care Bears go to the home front. It's just a Care Bear. It's just a Care Bear with a little roll of bandages.
Nurse bear. Creepy cousin. Spinster uh-huh. cousin bear. Medic bear.
Ambulance driver bear.
Mm-hmm. Trench bear.
Morphine distribution bear. Artillery bear.
They're all just shades of gray.
and tan. Don't forget the khaki. Yeah. You know.
Khaki.
Yeah.
Beige.
Blood spatter bear.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Jenny, now that she's established or begun to establish how much their world really revolves around Chris, she goes on to take some time to explain to us why Chris specifically is so special to them. And the portrait that she paints is of a man who is genuinely very, very kind, very sweet, and a romantic at heart. Like, she makes a point of telling us that when he was a child, he really believed in make-believe. He had a rich, immersive life of the mind.
Yeah.
And very much was a romantic at heart. And it says that as he aged, he exchanged his expectation of imagination for the equally wistful aspiration of becoming completely reconciled to life. It was his hopeless hope that sometime he would have an experience that would act on his life like alchemy, turning to gold all the dark metals of events, and from that revelation he would go on his way, rich with an inextinguishable joy. There had, of course, been no chance of his ever getting it. Literally, there wasn't room to swing a revelation in his crowded life. First of all, at his father's death, he had been obliged to take over a business that was weighted by the needs of a mob of female relatives who were all useless. Then Kitty...
Not me, though.
Not me, though. I'm different.
Yeah. Then, not like the other cousins.
I'm not like the other spinster cousins.
Yeah,
she says a mob of female relatives, but we never see any of the other ones, so I don't know if they just died
off. Maybe she got rid of them.
she just defenestrated them one by one.
Yeah.
This is actually all taking place in the wake of like an Hercule Poirot episode where she's caught for murdering a bunch of the other spinster relatives.
This is a horror novel.
I mean, well.
Stop! No!
Then Kitty had come along and picked up his conception of normal expenditure and carelessly stretched it as a woman stretches a new glove on her hand. Then there had been the difficult task of learning to live after the death of his little son. It had lain on us, the responsibility, which gave us dignity, to compensate him for his lack of free adventure by arranging him a gracious life. But now, just because our performance had been so brilliantly adequate, how dreary was the empty stage.
Okay, so what she's saying is he was a really imaginative and creative kid, and we got older, he thought he'd have a fun life, but then reality hit and a lot of serious things happened, like his dad died, his child died, and then... So she sees it as her job, her and his wife's job, to make his life as nice as possible.
Yeah, except the only thing I'll say is the implication isn't necessarily that he, I mean, yes, he was maybe hoping for a fun life, but it's a little more poetic than that.
Not, he's got, I don't that mean like fun, like woo, I mean like purposeful.
Yes, yeah, that exactly. Yeah. It's the implication here is that he's got like a little bit of a poet's soul, and that he's been sort of knocked down by one thing after another.
Yeah.
And of course, what she doesn't say at the end of that litany of negative experiences is he's at the front right now.
Yeah.
He's embroiled in trench warfare currently at this moment.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things is that as we go on, the war is almost never on the page. It is happening in the background completely silently. That mention at the very beginning of him not writing is as on the page as it gets for quite a while.
Okay.
Jenny and Kitty have sort of spun this existence that, at least insofar as Jenny is willing to admit to us and to herself, is meant to compensate Chris for sort of the loss of freedom from all of these things, you know,
yeah,
the business, the house, the marriage, the loss of the son, and now unspoken being at the front. But of course, being shipped away to war is the one thing that the two of them can't smooth over.
Yeah.
It's, he's gone.
So we're just going to ignore that. Well, and how reliable is Jenny?
Well, we'll
as
see.
A narrator? Is this how Kitty sees it as well?
I would say, so Jenny habitually sort of ropes Kitty into a lot of, she uses a lot of us.
Yeah.
When she's talking about these things. But you begin to get the impression pretty quickly, starting with the whole nursery comment, that Kitty is maybe not hugely fussed about a lot of these things. She's maybe not the most thoughtful soul on earth.
Okay. And maybe Jenny is a little too thoughtful.
Yeah. It's possible.
Okay. So between them, they have one average thought.
Between them, they're almost kind of normal.
Yeah.
Not really, though.
Uh-oh.
So Jenny has laid the scene for us and kind of given us the background on the dynamics of this household. And this is interrupted by the arrival of a visitor. You know, they're still sitting in the nursery while we're getting all of this backstory.
Yeah.
And a servant brings up, because of course the house is full of servants. It's very funny because the...
Okay. So when you said they were the only people on this estate, I was like, wow.
Well, they're the only real people.
I've been watching some British period TV and I know that's not true. All right. Carry on. There's like 10 other people.
There's so many people rattling around this house and we never meet any of them.
Yeah.
They're the only people with real feelings, Lee.
Does the staff have names?
No.
Or is it?
Okay. They are entirely inconsequential to this narrative, at least from Jenny and Kitty's perspective.
Yeah.
But the parlor maid brings Kitty a card, which reads, Mrs. William Gray, Mariposa, Lady Smith Road, Wealdstone. And Kitty says, I don't know anybody in Wealdstone.
Gross.
Which Jenny says is the name of the red suburban stain which fouls the fields 3 miles nearer London than Harrowfield.
Jesus Christ.
One cannot now protect one's environment as one once could.
Well, with like shooting them or something?
It's
or?
From not allowing, it's these horrible
new money
middle class suburbs. And one of the things,
oh, it's a suburb.
One of the things that's very funny is that this is a period in time, end of the Victorian era, you know, pivoting into the beginning of the 1900s, and what we now think of as charming Victorian architecture with like the brick row houses and everything.
Yeah.
Jenny mentions at least 6 times. She's like this ugly red brick, like
trash.
She's so, so mad about
disgusting.
It.
Disgusting.
So they have a visitor from one of these foul suburbs.
This is a hunk of shit.
They're going to go downstairs to see her. And Kitty starts out saying, I especially want to be kind to people while Chris is away. One wants to deserve well of heaven. And... then literally one beat later is like, the people who come breaking into one's nice, quiet day. Like she's, she can't even pretend to be like the gracious lady of the manor for more than about 30 seconds.
She's like, I'm so nice to people. I like people. I'm a good neighbor, except for them. They're gross. They're nasty. They shouldn't be here.
You've nailed the Kitty vibe immediately.
Okay. All right. Meow.
They get to the top of the stairs and they look down.
And they're like, bleh!
I mean, honestly, they look down at their guest and Kitty literally physically shivers.
All right.
And says, literally, let's get this over with.
She's like, poor.
Jenny's description of this woman. I cannot get over how mean the narration of this book is to how this woman looks.
Okay, I'm ready. Read it.
She lifted to Kitty a sallow and relaxed face. The bones of her bad stays clicked as she moved. Well, she was not so bad. Her body was long and round and shapely, and with a noble squareness of the shoulders. Her fair hair curled diffidently about a good brow. Her gray eyes, though they were remote, as if anything worth looking at in her life had kept a long way off, were full of tenderness. And though she was slender, there was something about her of the wholesome, endearing heaviness of the ox or the trusted big dog. Yet she was bad enough. She was repulsively furred with neglect and poverty, as even a good glove that has dropped down behind a bed in a hotel and has lain undisturbed for a day or two is repulsive when the chambermaid retrieves it from the dust and fluff.
She sounds kind of hot. Except for the whole... glove under the bed thing.
They're so mad about her clothes.
They're like, she looks good, but she dresses poor.
That is a lot of it. They keep talking about her pigskin purse with a burst seam that's in her alpaca. Let's see.
A lot of animal.
She's wearing
products.
It's they. She's compared to an animal so much, okay. Like so often.
Okay.
a sticky straw hat that had only lately been renovated by something out of a little bottle bought at the chemist's.
Hmm.
Everything about the way that she dresses and looks makes them nauseous.
Yeah.
And when they can bring themselves to compliment her at all, it's usually by comparing her to like a dog or a cow.
She looks sturdy like a cow.
Pretty much.
Well, I happen to like cows.
And this poor woman begins trying to explain why she's here.
Mm-hmm.
And she's
like, sorry, I can't hear you over how gross you are.
It's almost that. It's so close. She starts out by explaining that like her maid and one of their maids are friends. And they're like, we don't care. And then she's like, I just wanted you to understand that that's how I heard. And they're like, we still don't care. And she's like, your husband has been wounded.
Oh.
And Kitty and Jenny immediately lock eyes in quiet triumph because this woman is clearly here to scam them.
Okay. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, she's a scammer.
She's a dirty double crosser.
Presently, she would say that she had gone to some expense to come here with her news, and that she was poor. And at the first generous look on our faces, there would come some tale of trouble that would disgust the imagination by pictures of yellow wood furniture that a landlord oddly desired to seize, and a pallid child with bandages round its throat. I cast down my eyes and shivered at the horror. Yet there was something about the physical quality of the woman, unlovely though she was, which preserved the occasion from utter baseness. I felt sure that had it not been for the tyrannous emptiness of that evil, shiny pigskin purse that jerked around on her trembling knees, the poor driven creature would have chosen ways of candor and gentleness.
So she's poor and living in her kids in rags, but she has a maid and she's like wrapped in furs.
No, she's wearing an alpaca skirt.
Oh, okay.
She's wearing cheap, tacky clothing.
Okay.
She does have a maid.
She got a football purse.
Yeah, she's clearly...
She didn't have that football purse. She wouldn't be such a liar, but she does, so she is.
Yeah. She's got a tacky football purse. She has an umbrella that's apparently so ugly that it seems like it's about to make Kitty faint.
And what skin is that made of?
Tortoiseshell handle.
Okay.
With green seams.
Yeah.
That make Kitty physically ill.
Yeah.
Kitty and Jenny have decided that she's a scammer. She is... wildly uncomfortable with the whole thing, and you can, reading between the lines of Jenny's narration, you can tell that this poor woman is just beside herself and wildly uncomfortable with the situation that she's in.
Yeah.
They go on the offense. They're giving her a hard time. And she finally explains that she got a telegraph from Chris.
Ooh.
And they're like, the War Office would have told us if he'd been injured. And she... Sorry, really quick. I want to note that when they're mid-fight, Jenny describes her as being like a clumsy animal at a gate she was not intelligent enough to open.
Nice.
Yeah. And that she hated her as the rich hate the poor, as insect things that will struggle out of the crannies which are their decent home and introduce ugliness to the light of day.
Yeah, that sounds accurate.
Finally, this woman manages to kind of snap and be like, but Chris is ill. You don't understand. I couldn't bear to not let you know once I knew that you didn't know. I'm so sorry. And Kitty is furious and basically trying to throw her out. And it becomes clear that they knew each other, that Chris and this woman knew each other.
That's what I was, yeah.
At some point in the past.
Why'd she get a telegram?
She also lets slip that there have been letters, too. And Kitty demands to have them. And the woman's like, absolutely not. I'm so sorry. And she bolts.
Mm.
But the last thing she says is to tell them where the hospital is that Chris is in. And then she's gone.
Yeah, pigskin flapping behind her in the wind.
And Jenny believes her in part because...
Because she's too dumb and poor to lie.
Pretty much.
Oh, no.
I wanted to go out into the garden and sit by the pond until the poor thing had removed her deplorable umbrella, her unpardonable raincoat, her poor frustrated fraud. But Mrs. Gray, who had begun childishly and deliberately, "It's you who are being," and had desisted simply because she realized that there were no harsh notes on her lyre, and that she could not strike these chords that others found so easy, had fixed me with a certain wet, clear, patient gaze. It is the gift of animals and those of peasant stock. From the least regarded, from an old horse nosing over a gate, or a drab in a workhouse ward, it wrings the heart.
Looking at me with her dead cow eyes.
Pretty much.
with her wet livestock gaze. Ogling me.
So she runs off and Kitty reads the telegram and shows it to Jenny. And we don't have the text of it. But what we know is that...
It's like, my wife's a bitch. Stop. My cousin sucks. Stop.
Well, so what's confusing is that it's addressed to this woman by her maiden name. So her name is Margaret. She's mm-hmm. now Mrs. Gray. She was Margaret Allington. It's addressed to her maiden name. And apparently, and again, we don't get the text, includes like a pet name.
Maggie.
And...
Maggie baby.
As Kitty phrases
sexy
it.
Sexy cow eyes. My beautiful wet-eyed love.
My beautiful cow-eyed baby. As Kitty phrases it, it's common, the things that he's put in this telegram. Ugh. Kitty says, "It's queer he should have written such a message. Queer that he shouldn't have told me about knowing her. Queer that he ever should have known such a woman. It shows there are bits of him we don't know. Things may be awfully wrong. It's all such a breach of trust. I resent it." So she jumps straight to rage.
Yeah.
And Jenny's like, "But he's sick. He's ill. He's been wounded. He has...
He's concussed.
That's the most that they could get out of Margaret before she vanished, is that he's concussed.
Yeah.
And Kitty's closing word on the matter for the moment is, "What does that matter? If he could send that telegram, he is no longer ours."
I see where she's coming from. She's like, he's not that concussed, apparently. Still remembers all his little nicknames for nasty wet-eyed hoe.
Oh, old Margaret Cowies.
Yeah.
And the second chapter opens with a letter from Chris's cousin, Frank, who is in the church and therefore not serving in the military, who has gone to visit him because he also got a telegram from Chris saying that he was in France.
It's not looking good.
And immediately went over to the hospital
in
France to go see him. And he is writing to Jenny because he needs Jenny to brace Kitty.
No, boy. Chris is pregnant.
Chris has amnesia.
Oh. Sure.
So Chris has shell shock.
Okay.
And has completely lost the last 15 years of his life.
Soap opera ass book.
I know. It's completely gone.
Okay.
He does not know he is married. He does not know his father is dead. He doesn't remember his training. It's gone.
Yeah.
He is 21.
He's just a little baby.
In his head. Like, he thinks he is 21 again.
You know who's not going to like that? Miss Kitty. Mrs. Kitty. Sorry.
I don't know what you mean. She seems so emotionally resilient.
Yeah.
And on top of things. She seems so selfless and able to deal with a crisis.
Yeah.
His cousin, the vicar or whatever, shows up. And Chris opens by being like, "I'm in love with this girl."
Wait, I thought Jenny was the narrator. Who's narrating this?
He wrote them a letter.
So he's
written them a letter.
Yeah.
Explaining all of this. And he says that he showed up. And Chris, right off the bat, was like, "I'm in love.
Oh, Maggie Moo Moo.
I've been writing her letters and I'm going to marry her. And I need you to take some, I need to give you some money so that you can go. Like, I think she hasn't come to see me. Because money is tight. She and her father don't have a ton of money. So I'd like to give you some money so you can go get her and you can bring her here and we're going to get married."
Yeah.
And his cousin is like,
"You.
You have a wife. You like 110% have a wife."
Yeah.
"Her name is Kitty."
Yeah.
"She's a beautiful little woman. She loves to sing." And Chris
her
is like,
"Her hair's super dry."
Chris is like, "I hate women who sing."
Oh.
Chris is utterly heartbroken. He has no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
And I realize that amnesia is overdone and a tough sell. And I don't 100% understand the science between it in the real world.
Yeah.
But within the context of this book.
As a book, it's fiction.
It's It is very real.
Yeah.
He has completely lost 15 years of his life.
It happens.
And his cousin is like, you're an old man with response. Like, you're 36.
You've got an estate with 47 people living on it.
Yeah, pretty much.
45 of whom don't matter. Don't worry about them.
The cousin's letter closes with, in the meantime, I leave it to you to prepare Kitty for this terrible shock. I could have wished it were a woman of a different type who was to see my poor cousin through these dark days. But convey to her my deepest sympathy. Indeed, I never realized the horror of warfare until I saw my cousin, of whose probity I am as firmly convinced as of my own, wantonly repudiating his most sacred obligations.
Mm.
In terms of just the overall arc of the novel, what his cousin seems most shocked by is not, oh, my poor cousin's brain has been scrambled like an egg.
Yeah.
It's, oh, my cousin has been reduced by the horrors of war into violating manners and decency.
Yeah. You know, British.
Which is a much bigger problem, apparently.
Yeah.
Kitty is reading this letter over Jenny's shoulder, which we find out as soon as we get to the end of the letter, and Kitty loses it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
The first thing she says is, and he always pretended he liked my singing.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems like something she would say.
And then she starts screaming that they need to bring him home. And so they do.
I'm sure it all goes well, and there's not much left of the book. I'm sure it all works out in the end.
Never been better.
Yeah.
So Chris arrives.
Uh-huh.
He obviously still remembers Jenny because they grew up together.
Yeah.
They've known each other since they were children.
Cousins.
But the first thing that he reacts to with Jenny is that she's so old.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
In his head, he is 21. Jenny is 20. And Kitty...
doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Kitty's a complete stranger.
He's like, who's that old angry woman over there?
And he comes in and his first reaction is to be suffused with joy at the parts of the house that are still familiar to him. And then he sees Jenny and that kind of stumbles.
He's like,
ugh. Yeah. And then he sees Kitty. It is underlined that he's a nice man. Like, he doesn't want to hurt her.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's trying very hard.
He's like, get out of my house, please. Please.
You can tell that he kind of wants to do that, but he's a sweet and honorable man.
Yeah.
So he's trying to go through the motions, but he is also desperately still in love with this Margaret woman.
Yeah.
And so he goes to
with
try
old Moo-moo.
With old Moo-moo eyes. So he tries to go to kiss Kitty and he literally can't bring himself to do it.
Sorry. Just give me a second.
And she takes it super well.
Uh-huh. As we know she would.
They both default into the roles of sort of the English gentry. He goes to kiss her and can't. She withdraws to the other side of the room and basically starts rattling off logistics at him.
Logistics about what?
Dinner and, you know, that kind of thing. Jenny says, so she's going off about, you know, I ordered dinner and this and this and this. And it says, she said it very smartly, with her head on one side like a bird, as if she was pleading that he would find her very clever about ordering dinner and thinking of his comfort.
Yeah.
So.
You know what? She did what was within her power to do.
She has. And.
Which is make 45 other people do it.
And he starts to go upstairs. And as he's heading up the stairs, Jenny has this panicky realization that the whole second floor of the house has been renovated because his childhood bedroom that he thinks he's about to go back to is gone. It's been hoovered up by Kitty renovating her own bedroom and making it huge. And it like took a bunch of other rooms. And so it's just,
you know, Kitty's kind of a serv. I don't know.
That's fine. You know, you're allowed to like Kitty.
I hate like her.
That's fine.
You know, I'm just, what's she going to do next?
I'm getting Jessica Walters and Arrested Development vibes a little
bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, just like, sure.
And so from Chris's perspective, it's just all these little shocks, right? There are just, things are different.
Cousin's old, rooms are gone.
The interior of the house has changed.
Yeah.
When they go into dinner, he falls down a short flight of stairs that didn't used to be there. Mm. That kind of thing.
How embarrassing.
But before they make it to dinner, so he goes upstairs to get dressed for dinner.
Yeah.
Jenny's like,
screams, faints.
Your room's not there.
Yeah. Falls into a hole.
They all go get changed. And Kitty comes downstairs a little bit before Chris makes it back down. I saw that she was dressed in all respects like a bride. The gown she wore on her wedding day 10 years ago had been cut and embroidered as this white satin was. Her hair had been coiled low on her neck, as it was now. Around her throat were her pearls and her longer chain of diamonds, looking cruelly bright. I saw that her right hand was stiff with rings and her left hand bare, save for her wedding ring. With her lip thrust out, as if she were considering a menu, she lowered her head and looked down at herself. She frowned to see that the high lights on the satin shone scarlet from the fire, that her flesh glowed like a rose, and she changed her seat for a high-backed chair beneath the farthest candle sconce. There were green curtains close by, and now the lights on her satin gown were green like cleft ice. She looked as cold as moonlight, as virginity, but precious. The falling candlelight struck her hair to bright, pure gold. So she waited for him.
See, that's kind of a serve. That's some Real Housewives shit. Where it's like, so, you don't remember that we're married? Well, guess what? I'm wearing my fucking wedding dress, bitch.
Not just that, but she has put on every piece of jewelry he's ever bought her.
Yeah, she's like, you're gonna remember now. I mean, is it a little mean? Sure. Is it funny? Yes.
And then that's about when he falls down the little flight of stairs that wasn't there before. And it says, Kitty knitted her brows, for she hates gracelessness, and a failure of physical adjustment is the worst indignity she can conceive.
Slapstick.
Pretty much.
It's not funny.
She's not a fan.
Wait, what's his name again?
Chris.
It's not funny, Chris. Get up. I'm wearing my wedding dress, God damn it.
And he comes in and she says, it's so strange that you don't remember me. You gave me all of these. And she like waves at the jewelry.
That's like, she's like, I also have our marital butt plug. I'm wearing it now. Don't you remember?
The 21st century version would be like a suitcase of sex toys.
Yeah.
Just like, but baby, don't you remember buying me this?
Don't you remember this one? Don't you remember the strap?
And he, bless him, all he can say is, I'm glad I did that. You look very beautiful in them. She is not impressed.
Yeah.
And they go and have dinner, and they're all trying to maintain the illusion of normalcy. And Jenny is watching Chris. Every time he's trying to engage with them conversationally, he looks crushed and kind of panicked.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also, anytime he sees something familiar, so like a salt cellar, little tchotchkes and pieces of furniture that are familiar, that go back to his childhood,
mm-hmm.
he's overwhelmed with joy to like see and touch these familiar things.
Yeah.
But every time he's drawn back into the moment and has to converse like, with them,
God.
He panics.
Yeah.
And it's very sad.
I mean, yeah, that sounds like a confusing evening.
Jenny says, it was his furtiveness that was heartrending. It was though he were an outcast, and we who loved him stout policemen. Was Baldry Court so sleek a place that the unhappy felt offenders there? Then we had all been living wickedly, and he too.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's like a prison now.
It is. And I lied. One of the servants does get a name because he and Jenny wind up kind of pivoting the conversation back to their childhood, which is a much more neutral topic because obviously they were both there.
Yeah.
And he brings up some question or other and she says, I don't know. And he goes, oh, Griffiths will know. And he spins around to ask Griffiths.
Griffiths is dead.
The butler.
He's been dead for 15 years.
7 years. Oh. He's been dead for 7 years.
Rest in peace, Griffiths.
And he's, I mean, it just.
Oh, that's. He's like, let's ask Griffiths. Jenny's like.
Just like, oh, no.
No, don't turn around. No.
I mean, and, you know, in the hospital, his cousin had to tell him that his father was dead. Like he.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And you're married to Kitty. And like, no.
And this, I think, is West wants to make absolutely sure that we are absolutely sure that Chris is not faking this.
Yeah, got
and
it.
That especially because he is a gentleman and a gentleman, that he would never create the kind of discomfort in the people around him that he is creating if he could at all help it.
Yeah.
Because to roll up on your butler and be like, you're not Griffiths, is not cool.
Yeah.
And also to underline just how subconscious it is, right? He's falling downstairs. This world he's in is utterly alien to him.
Yeah. Sorry, Christopher. If only he had an angry spouse to belittle him how he did it. While looking fabulous.
While looking fab. While wearing all but a wedding dress.
So, I wish she had her full veil down in front of her face at the table.
Just going full Miss Havisham. Like, yeah. You don't remember this? Just coming downstairs in 1916 lingerie. Like,
yeah.
It is interesting that she doesn't try
the sexy angle.
She doesn't. I don't know if Rebecca West didn't want to make Kitty come across as
Vulgar,
or if she was trying to imply that one of the reasons there wouldn't ever be a second child is that they weren't
doing it.
That their marriage had gone cold.
Yeah.
And it certainly does seem that Kitty is primarily upset at the indignity of it all.
Yeah.
Not that she is pining for Chris to love her the way that he did before, because it seems a little debatable.
Yeah. She's like, I'm sorry I don't have a pigskin purse, Chris.
They make it through dinner, just barely. And
Griffiths didn't.
Sorry. Griffiths
doesn't manage to make it through dinner.
He did not. He wasn't there. They just barely make it through dinner. And Chris sort of can't help himself. He goes to Kitty and he says that he's so sorry, but he says, I know my conduct must seem to you perversely insulting, but if I do not see Margaret Allington, I shall die.
And what does she say? I assume she just bursts into flames. I assume she physically ignites.
Almost.
Yeah.
It says, she raised her hands to her jewels and pressed the cool globes of her pearls into her flesh. She lives near here, she said easily. I will send the car down for her tomorrow. You shall see as much of her as you like.
Oh.
And Chris thanks her and sort of...
He's like, oh, great, thanks.
He skedaddles off into the darkness because he is not... He might be lovesick, but he's not an idiot.
Yeah.
He just Homer Simpsons out of the room into the darkness and... This is what happens when he leaves the room.
Takes a fork and stabs it in her thigh.
This is from Jenny's perspective.
Okay.
I was amazed at Kitty's beautiful act and more amazed to find that it had made her face ugly. Her eyes snapped as they met mine. That Dowd, she said, keeping her voice low so that Chris might not hear it. That Dowd! This sudden abandonment of beauty and amiability meant so much in our Kitty, whose law of life is grace, that I went over and kissed her. Dear, you're taking things all the wrong way, I said. Chris is ill. He's well enough to remember her, all right, she replied unanswerably. Her silver shoe tapped the floor. She pinched her lips for some moments. After all, I suppose I can sit down to it. Other women do. Teddy Rex keeps a gaiety girl, and Mrs. Rex has to grin and bear it. She shrugged in answer to my silence. What else is it, do you think? It means that Chris is a man like other men. But I did think that bad women were pretty. I suppose he's had so much to do with pretty ones that a plain one's a change.
I mean...
And then she goes on, apparently, to say some things that are so insulting that Jenny refuses to relate them.
Oh, wow.
It says, her little pink mouth went on manufacturing malice. This is all a blind, she said at the end of an unpardonable sentence. He's pretending.
This is Real Housewives.
Real Housewives 1916.
Yeah. Wait, where are they again?
They are in the English countryside in a place called Harrowweald.
Real Housewives Harrowweald.
Very much so. So she storms off to bed.
Yeah.
And Chris reemerges now that it's quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And he sits down with Jenny. They sit by the fire and for the first time with Kitty gone, he truly relaxes. And Jenny sits there kind of being,
hey.
Pretty much.
Cousin. Hey, cuz.
And she asks him for a final time, do you really not remember Kitty? And he says, in a sense, I know how she bows when you meet her in the street, how she dresses when she goes to church. I know her as one knows a woman staying in the same hotel. Just like that.
Hmm.
And Jenny tries to remind him that Kitty's been a good wife to him. And, well, that's what everyone keeps saying throughout the rest of the book. This is a thing that people are going to keep saying. And he asks her, sort of for a final time, is all of this really real?
Yeah.
Is this really, am I really old? Are you really old? Is Kitty really my wife? And Jenny's like, yeah.
Yeah, bro.
But because it's just the two of them, he finally tells her the story of Margaret Allington.
That whore. That common whore.
That bitch. The summer that he was 21, he was staying with his uncle at a different estate somewhere out in the country, which was near a place called Monkey Island, which is an island in the Thames. It's a real place. It's very small.
Uh-huh.
And it has an inn on it.
That's where the tacky poor blonde women live.
And
picked one out.
Margaret is the daughter of the innkeeper.
Ah.
Who owns the inn on Monkey Island. And I know.
Sorry.
I don't know how it got the name. It's a real place.
The daughter of the innkeeper on Monkey Island. I fell in love with her one summer back when I was only 21 before the war.
I mean, you've pretty much nailed it. That's basically the whole thing.
Okay. Let me just finish the book from here on out. I got this, Grace.
And they are...
Was she a fair lass? Sorry.
Yeah, she was. You know, she's...
She Bonnie?
She was. She was Bonnie and fair and sweet.
Yeah.
And he and she fell deeply, deeply in love.
Mm.
And I'm going to gloss a little bit over the romance. But it's very sweet. If you ever read the book, it's lovely. And it does a very good job conveying the most important thing, which is that he and Margaret really do clearly, truly love one another.
Sure.
But for the purposes of this podcast...
Is there lust? Is there sexiness?
Middlingly?
Yeah. Okay.
They spend these wonderful long days together, mm-hmm. and he tells Jenny about an evening where, you know, he's pushing her around in a boat.
Is that what she calls?
Yeah, he's punting. Basically, you can only get to the island by, you know, on a boat, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of her jobs is to go over and retrieve people and then take them back.
Gotta ask them three questions underneath the bridge. Make sure they answer right before she can take them over to Monkey Island in her boat.
It's true. She's got big cow eyes and also needs you to answer these riddles three.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it says that they're in the boat in the evening and it's gotten dark. And it says, she was then just a girl in white who lifted a face or drooped a dull gold head. Then she was nearer to him than any other time. That he loved her in this twilight, which obscured all the physical details which he adored, seemed to him a guarantee that theirs was a changeless love, which would persist if she were old or maimed or disfigured. And
I'm gonna like her even if she's not hot.
Yeah, which...
Aw.
Yeah, it's the 19-teens. I feel like that's pretty big.
Aw.
That's a lot of people entered into marriages on less.
She's poor and she might not be hot one day, but I'll still like her.
Yes.
Cousin.
And...
I forgot he was telling all this to his cousin.
Yes.
Sure.
Sure. And they're so, so in love with each other. And he's relating all of this. And he's decided that, you know, without Margaret, his life is meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
And then it ends. They go out into the woods. It seems...
Wait. Who do...
He and Margaret. Sorry.
Back
in the past.
Okay,
yeah,
in
sorry.
The story.
Bad transition.
Yeah.
In the story he's telling.
Yeah.
They are alone on the island for the evening. Her father has gone off to do something.
How big is this island?
It's very small. I get the impression.
But there's a forest on it.
There's some trees.
Okay.
There's.
They go into the six trees.
Woods is maybe a strong.
Okay. Got it. Sorry.
It's an island that is big enough to hold an inn
and
some like nice grounds.
Okay.
But not too much more than that.
Yeah.
They sneak off together. It seems pretty strongly implied that they're going to do it.
Boink.
And it says, A strong stream of moonlight rushed upon her there. Mm-hmm. By its light, he could not tell if her hair was white as silver or yellow as gold. And again, he was filled with exaltation, because he knew that it would not have mattered if it had been white. His love was changeless. Lifting her down from the niche, he told her so. And as he spoke, her warm body melted to nothingness in his arms. The columns that had stood so hard and black against the quivering tide of moonlight and starlight seemed to totter and dissolve. He was lying in a hateful world where barbed wire entanglements showed impish knots against a livid sky full of blooming noise and splashes of fire and wails for water, and his back was hurting intolerably.
Wait.
So that's what he has experienced, is that they were together on Monkey Island.
And then he's in the trenches.
And then he was in the trenches, freshly wounded.
So it's Margaret's fault. So she melted to nothingness in his arms. And then...
And that's... Yeah. That's it. That's,
and that's
the last,
how he got there.
That's the last thing he remembers.
Mm.
Everything else is gone.
Yeah.
The last thing he remembers is being more in love with this woman than he has ever loved anything in his entire life.
Yeah.
And then the next thing he remembers after that is the immediate aftermath of being wounded.
Hmm. Bummer.
And now he's home.
Got a wife.
Yeah, got a wife.
Yeah. Doesn't seem to like him very much.
Very confused.
Yeah. There's stairs here now.
Yeah. And it's...
Griffiths is gone.
Griffiths is gone.
Yeah.
And he's just completely baffled.
Yeah.
And it...
Sounds baffling.
Yeah. It doesn't sound fun.
No.
So he explains all of this to Jenny, and he closes with, if you had seen the way he's talking about, they have this long, very lingering romantic scene where she's leaning her face against a glass window as they talk, and she's looking into the parlor of the inn and talking about the things she wants to do with her life and the places she wants to go. Yeah. And, you know, the way that young people
do. Someday this whole island will be mine.
Not quite, but yeah,
okay.
Kind of. It's a little more like, someday maybe we'll, you know, be together and we can go experience the world. Like,
yeah.
They're both romantics.
Yeah.
He says, if you had seen the way she rested her cheek against the glass and looked into the little room.
She's like. That's not going to translate on podcast.
No, it's not.
I was licking the glass.
It was hot.
Yeah.
If you had seen the way she rested her cheek against the glass and looked into the little room, you'd understand that I can't say, yes, Kitty's my wife, and Margaret somehow just nothing at all. And that's the situation he finds himself in.
Yeah.
And the next thing that happens is Margaret, dowdy, horrible raincoat and umbrella
ugly cow Margaret.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is gonna show up on the scene.
Oh. At the house now.
At
tonight.
Yep. No, not tonight. But the next day.
With her disgusting turtle umbrella.
With her horrible clothes.
And her llama skirt.
And her alpaca skirt. And Kitty's gonna handle it.
Well.
So well.
Yeah.
Like the most well.
It's just gonna be the four of them and 45 other people.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Dun, dun, dun! Next time on
Days
of Our Estates.
So when we get together next, we're going to find out what happens when Margaret turns up on the scene.
Drama!
For now, we're going to put a little bit of a pin in it. But before we go, I have a question for you.
Me?
Yes,
for
you.
For me, okay.
Yeah. Where do you think we're headed? Where do you think this is going to go?
I don't know.
And
murder?
All right, good guess.
No.
Homicide?
So no?
Maybe.
Oh.
We don't know.
You're not going to tell me.
No, I'm not.
I don't know. I don't think it'll be happy.
Yeah, no, probably not.
Okay.
I mean, World War I literature, famously uplifting.
Maybe he'll go back to the front. Maybe he'll be like, this.
Bye.
Yeah.
Follow-up question.
Okay.
If you were Kitty.
Yeah.
In this moment, what would you do?
Dude, I don't know. Because me personally, nowadays, I'd be like, whatever, I didn't like him anyway. Give me some money in the divorce. I'm going to go off and do my own thing. But I don't think that's Kitty's...
No. Also, it's 1916.
Yeah.
So, like,
that's not a thing that happens.
Nope.
So... What would I do if I were her? Probably just make everyone's lives miserable for the rest of my ability to do so. Just wear my wedding dress every single day.
Just lash out. So just turn into Miss Havisham.
I have heard that name, but I've not I don't know that story.
Charles Dickens, Great Expectations. She's abandoned at the altar and then spends the next like 60 years just wearing a wedding dress, refuses to change or clean up the wedding decorations.
It'd either be that or I'd just start having copious affairs with anyone and everyone.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah, which sounds more fun.
Yeah.
Than the whole wearing the same dress every single day.
I mean, spoilers, this is not what's going to happen, but I feel like there's another story.
Yeah.
Wherein she's just like, oh, you and Margaret are a thing? Okay. That, like, that's...
Well, guess what? Me and Bob are a thing.
Yeah. And Chris would probably...
Bob, get in here.
And Chris would probably be like, okay.
And be like, I don't care. Yeah. I don't know who you are.
I could not be less bothered. Well, that is it for now.
Yeah.
Lee's literally unraveling before me.
A thread came out of my sock.
Lee, any last thoughts? Anything you would like to, I don't know, promote, brag about?
About me personally.
About anything. I have accepted that if I ask if you have anything to promote or if there's anywhere you would like people to find you, that you're just going to be like, no, leave me alone. So is there anything you would like to promote on someone else's behalf?
I don't know. Donate to mutual aid.
Perfect.
Call your legislators about a ceasefire.
Perfect. All right. Great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for being here with me.
No problem.
It's been great, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
What's Margaret and Kitty? Are you Team Margaret or Team Kitty?
I'm currently the narrator, so I feel like I shouldn't pick sides.
Boring.
But to the listeners out there.
Yeah. Hashtag Team Dead Cow Eyes or Team... or Team...
Team
Wedding
Dress.
I wear my wedding dress every day. Hashtag drama.
Sound off in the comments.
Yeah. Like and subscribe. Thank you. Smash that like button.
Let us know which heartbroken woman in this World War I novel you would like to parasocialize with.
Mm-mm.
And as always, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate having you with us. And we will see you again next week.
Hey, thank you so much.
And in the meantime, if you can, this week, this month, this pay period, consider supporting a living author, because they could sure use the love.
Bye.
Goodbye. Until I forgot, I said I need less talk, a little more space, and need to know my feelings, but my words get in the way. I never really think straight, and you walked away. I ain't good at noticing, I know I gotta change. I heard you're back in town, you're coming around. I know I did before, but I'll never let you down. I see you looking my way, I felt the wind change. We can try again and make it summer every day. I know you've been down, I'm still the one in your heart. But we could get together and we'll never be apart. I wanna